not because I'm waiting for an urgent phone call, it's because of my watch or clock or whatever. So yeah, I never know where to start. And wherever I decide to start, I normally change it by the time it gets to this point in the evening. So in the break between the workshop and the reading, I went for a walk around that, Patrick Street. There's a street off that called French Church Street, which I presume, but I haven't investigated it yet, means there was a Huguenot church here, as there are French churches in lots of places in Britain and Ireland. So I decided to start by reading a poem about, sort of about my Huguenot ancestors, but it's kind of, it's not one of those ancestral poems. It kind of imagines coming into a town somewhere between the Middle Ages and now, the whole of the past rolling back. And it's called rather inelegantly at the moment Le Bienvenu des Chiens, which means the welcome of the dogs. And it's kind of like one of those images from a picture in the Middle Ages with all the dogs of the village following you into the town. We were having a discussion of a translation earlier and how you never get the idiom right. So you take a risk when you call it something like that. In France, a dog's welcome is probably something totally inappropriate and unsuitable. So just work with the town for a minute. There must be dogs in the street, called up, dog whistled from man marking the town's Jeux de Ballon Gavroches, next year's, next century's patriotic Algerian strikers, the Zinedine Zidane's de Londemain. There ought to be, waving above drying sheets hung from windows, the Grand Mère and Huguet, the arrière Grand Mère that my forebear Francois, Vere Provost et Discret, and Royal Notary like his father's, de Pères et Fils, from the Kansas MC Ecla, lived among till the edict that sent him by Mount Nod via Harold's Cross to Templastra was nailed to his 12th century door jamb. There should be players, the Tabor, the Perigord Chabret, Gascon Cornemuse, filling the midday with Brouillon Oise, unbridled chaos. There might be tallow dipped faggots by night, enlightening alleys and ramparts, as one commune de Vigneron or another, over scrubby hills and Limousin or Bouche du Rhône, long past disputation in this secular Europe of the regions, welcomes back her fils perdu from the glens, from La Patente, from Stephen's Green, the silversmiths, luthiers, French polishers, the Francois they wouldn't know, breaking his stout Occitan heart, toting an Armagnac ton up steep Antrim Calanx. Our regroup Huguenot brigade come in peace with rucksacks of saucisson and crottin de chèvre. There should be excess in fatted calves, or if not, solo vache qui rit in net bags and chipsters and Nutella, and post-horn gallops preceding enseignements from speakers lashed to the merry shutters. But more, much more than this, there must be dogs. So that's a kind of a gallop across 400 years of European history. This one is about my hometown of Ballycastle. The one thing you'll hear about Ballycastle again and again in the news every minute is that Cardinal Keith O'Brien was born in Ballycastle. Up to now, Ballycastle has kept its head down for most of my lifetime, but there we go. And this one's about a local myth, although the hotel has been renamed as the Marina Hotel in a reference to a Russian poet of that name. It's about a local myth that in the monastery in Ballycastle, the Franciscan friary, there was a nun who lived there in a guest house on her own, a member of the local sort of one of the old Gaelic families, and she prophesied that Ireland would be free whenever Russian men would arrive at Ballycastle Harbour with snow on their caps. Pretty normal sort of thing to prophesy. So this is at the Marina Hotel. It's one night in about 1968, at the Marina Hotel. We'd lived too long with that unorthodox nun's sooth, a land bound for freedom when Muscovy men, skiffings of snow or hail bristling their bear coats, would set foot in our estuary, not to feel a frisson as this reefer jacket crew at the Cold War's height. How high is a war? An iron curtain. Trooped unstoppably, or not having yet for an answer, into the velour residence lounge, gumboots off, socked feet on glass-topped coffee tables, the one with Trotsky lunettes, scant prices, translated cocktails to barracking laughs, then black cigarettes all around, Soviets, sure, but Moscow or Petrograd, Marina or Anna, such demarcations mattered until one produced a one-row garmon from his duffel and started with the strident fourth that is Stenka Razin. We hummed along with "The Carnival is Over," plumping for Marina or Orthodox Nun. Was the poem Trotsky declaimed her Hamelin or the Browning version? Either way, Kevin was taken with them. That's not a figure. Kevin was, after a long Vladivar night of the soul, taken with them. The postcard from Christiana about all souls on the atomic neutral Iceland beachhead, a few English Catholics wandering from Polaris to their consulate Kursk to Partsing at Cherny's Vaughan, then a second, arrested on Nevsky for counter-revolutionary attitudes outside the cathedral on spilled blood, then nothing, nada, zilch. Liam slouched off after another rough piece that would lower over our next 30 years. As for me, I bought the one-row garmon for a night's power earnings, remembered the poet's name, and discovered the 17th century nun's prophecy had no hint of snow, had Russian galleons arriving with their topsails on fire. So I'm going to read some poems from this book, and it's hard to get into as well because, as it says in the cover, it's a story of, well, part of the story is about when I was 11 years old and my mother died. So the title of the book, The Year of Not Dancing, is kind of about that year and about the whole sense of things that you'll never do again. We'll come to that poem. But how I got into the writing the poems, and I've been writing poetry for a long time and I've never really been able to tackle this issue. And I was walking along the Great West Road in London one evening and saw a car crash and saw motorcycles being lifted on a stretcher and carried to an ambulance, and suddenly thinking not about the drama of the car crash but about the slow burning drama of the family at home who would get the news that this guy hadn't come home, and how that would affect them down through, well, from my perspective, down through the rest of their lives. So the poem's called For Years. Almost unbidden, more sigh than tacit prayer in a heartfelt world, not for one fellow homefarer, hefted chest high and still among crash-helmeted day-glow bearers, held homeward under red blankets this rushing hour, rain-soft Monday, to the slightly aggrieved mumbling of 2,000 turbos. But for someone piercing film on a vegetable tikka masala in a new cul-de-sac on the floodplain southwest of the reservoir, parrying persistent entreaties between news and EastEnders, redialing a number that rings in a lock Samsonite in admissions 1-3-drawer cabinet. Or for someone on a black plastic chair, days afterwards, registering death where they last come, both with good news. And for the kids alone among crowds, packets and polycarps in September, and for next Guy Fawkes, for Augusts that fail differently from others' failed family sorties, and being unequal to speaking for years, for 40 or more years. And so that goes on to a series of poems about my mother's illness and her death, and then the days after. And this one's called After Days in Blind Drawn Rooms. Some of you who are old enough will know that maybe it still happens in some places, but it was a death in the house that pulled the blinds down, and we were kids, family of seven. So we kind of huddled in there. Of course, there were people coming and going, but we were in that house with the blinds drawn for about a week, and Saturday was the following Saturday. Was sort of my first day out. And it's one of those things about suddenly realising you're living in the grown-up world. Heaney talks about it in Funerals, about we shouldered a kind of manhood, but when you're a certain age and as an Adam, you're kind of neither adult enough to be treated as an adult, but you're not with the little kids anymore. And death is something that you have to face up to. So, After Days in Blind Drawn Rooms. Odd, a grown-up speaking to you in the street, like you were a real person, the enveloped card in the empty wicker basket, and you knew what it looked like without seeing, with dozens at home, masses, perpetual offerings. But she met you at Archie McKinley's and turned and stepped along with you and coughed down the road past Malloy's with the 16 bay windows, past the fire station, by Blackmore's Coal and the market yard, Weybridge's threshers, Lister twine balers, and you said you were due up at the Legion of Mary, but this was the first anyone said that they knew what you felt. And by the foot of the hill you were doing the cantata, bright as the sun and terrible as an army, my soul doth magnify, verse and response, like a two-handed routine. And then you could see her, instead of somebody's mum in a seafront, dormer-roofed house, aproned and calling and making and sending, you saw her a girl in a belted coat and a grey, blind-drawn house, one March Friday evening between two wars, missing her own Legion meeting in some kind of chapel, kneeling at home by the brother who died, a brother she'd never stopped thinking of since, but hadn't had much cause to mention. No need until now. The next one from that set is about being off in Dublin on a family holiday the following summer with my father and seven of us, and his family, his brother and sister were coming down. We were staying in the guest house and they were going to come down and help out with the kids. But the first night there, he and my brother and I went out for chips. This is something we treat. Chips crumble, quite a lot of these crumble. There's one called Dance Lessons that has chips in it as well. So we're at a boarding house in the Clontarf Road in Dublin. Lido Cafe. First he taught us to step off the back of a moving CIE bus, run a few steps to absorb momentum before turning back, like he'd done on the Crumlin Road in his theology student days. Then how to sprinkle vinegar down into the paper column, even if it wasn't a telegraph, before dredging with salt, lightly juggling heat. First time we'd seen a plastic tomato of ketchup or smoked glass coffee cups. First time we'd been out in a cafe together, the girls asleep in Mrs. McKee's on the Clontarf Road, his brother and sister coming down next day to help out with the seven of us, but tonight just John, me and him on a CIE bus. Next poem is, and the poems then go on to growing up and moving off to London and so on. And this next is from my early days in London. And it's called Pavlova's Dogs, which is obviously a reference to Pavlov's dogs, and the idea of conditioning and how you can be trained to react to something, except my Pavlov's dogs aren't just, what would you call Pavlov? A behaviourist. They aren't just some behaviourist scientist. They belong to a service performer called Pavlova, so there's kind of a lot of different things happening here. But it's basically about driving around London. You've got that? So, Pavlova's Dogs. In the three-ring circus of memory, he knew how the crash of the hi-hat at the start of the gallop from Orpheus was the cue for the waistcoated tumblers and cowgirls to whip back the flaps while Fanfandel shooed out the dabbled grey steed with the pooch on its saddle. The balance depended on terror, as sure as his own hands were glued to the car steering wheel on this second or third lap of the Savoy Circus ring. But the secret as yet undefined was whether the terrified yelp told the Shetland to exit the ring before the dog lost its nerve and absconded, or whether the final crescendo was the cue for the pony, or whether the well-drilled saxophonist watched for the poodle to give them the nod. In either case, driving to Wagner on a radio blind to his signals, he had several circuits to go. So lots of city poems in my work, partly from living in London, but the cities that I like best is, well, sentimental, but the cities I like best are cities about the size of Cork. You know, what I mean about that is, having spent a lot of my growing up time in Belfast, my university days there, I found that cities like Cork, Belfast, Manchester, Paris, Florence, you can walk from one side to the other in a day. You can do that in London if you're a real enthusiast, but it's like 35 miles. But in places this size, everything's in one place, and it's kind of what I'm familiar with. And this is a kind of a composite, mostly Belfast, a little bit of Glasgow has crept in here, but it's about a city. And it's about, I suppose, being loyal to a city. So in an odd way, it's about my... where it came to be, there's a line towards the end from, I think, from the prophet Isaiah, which is a song that says, "Here I am, Lord, I will hold your people in my heart," and it's the idea of being committed to people And my brother's a parish priest in a very bad area in Belfast, and I kind of came with the idea that, I walked out and I left the place, you know. So it's easy to write love songs to a city when you don't actually have to live with it. Yeah. And I use the word polis very deliberately at the beginning, because polis is the root meaning of the city, the metropolis, etc. But also in Glasgow, it's the polis, or the police, which comes from the same root word, polis, because they're policing the polis. City love songs. Polis of nail scissored green, Taiwan electric blue guitars with tremolo arm, hooked before Rogation Sunday and the final catalogue payment, of pledged nine irons and bull workers, tough brown carry out bags, walk-ins welcome at the head gardeners, of white lemonade and black taxis, and pay no more than 30 a score on lit subway and tenement walls, where they'll sort lost ignition keys, continental models no bother, out of any hours will have your SIM unlocked and other services, and off before you felt the mobile's absence. City where the celebrated Niagaran funambulist would walk his last wire, seething locus of the Sparadigm paradigm, source of lethal dejections and active contrition, of wall-to-wall licensed grocers, eat as much as you like, heavenly buffet and Alex Detoxville juice bar, shield each one of us, home or away, straight or getting straight, inside or out, with thy unceasing patronage, and forever, on account of her dress rings from earlier loves, and the Gibson Dobro mandolin we traded at Joe Cavanaugh's I Buy Anything, well before the incendiary business, for a rough night passage to Haitian, I will hold your people in, the bleeding oracles and ventricles of what passes lately for my heart. So, a nice thing about that poem is that Joe Cavanaugh's was kind of typical second-hand music shop where you buy some clarinets, electric guitars, and all that sort of stuff, and they crop up in every city. A lot of them were pawn shops that became music shops. But I read this at a launch of a magazine called The Wolf, and the event was held in the Rada Foyer in Bloomsbury in London. And this city guy came up to me afterwards in a city suit, you know, that kind of black coat with a fur collar around it that really sharp business types wear. And he said, yeah, you mentioned Joe Cavanaugh there. And I said, oh yeah, I used to spend all my time there. He said, yeah, Joe Cavanaugh was my dad. And he's now top city stockbroker or something. But his dad was the, I won't say the rag and bone man, but the junk shop with all the good musical instruments in it. So, and now a love poem called Dandelion Clock, which, as everybody knows, the Dandelion Clock, the number of times you blow it tells you whether she loves me, she loves me, etc. Or it tells you the time, I guess, because that's what's called the Dandelion Clock, isn't it? But, and the inspiration for this poem, we were talking earlier about inspirations for poems, the inspiration for this poem was that I was driving in Bavaria and passed a coach which had a brilliant picture of a butterfly on the side of it, a tourist coach, and the word Schmetterling, and I thought Schmetterling was such a nice word, I better get it into a poem. And it was only years afterwards that I thought, after I'd been reading the poem, that I should check that Schmetterling is actually the word for a butterfly and not the name of some German family who hire out coaches. And it turns out that Schmetterling is a butterfly. in fact, the words for butterflies all around the world are really interesting. I've got a whole list of them here, but look them up on Wiki. They're really, every one is a beautiful word. Dandelion Clock. If once in the runnels of years in a silver light something like this, I'm catching a soupçon of glance that might have disproved that you can't ever know what the person closest to you really feels. If he'd woven at that very point in the fractions that make up a life, a tentative net of abstractions to fling at the exiting moment, at the light, illusory, flittering, shreddering of once long ago, as it quivered above, behind, out of range of their hesitant gaze, and out through a sliver of sun between curtains on anodized rails they'd have bought at a paint shop in Redcar. Perhaps then they'd have known for sure. So, next poem, people always talk about stepping into dead men's shoes, and this poem's called lots of my poems are called On Something, or Not Buying a Dog, or On First Leg in the Chapel Summer, or that's somebody else's. So this one's called On Not Putting On Dead Men's Shoes. And I was kind of fascinated by photographs of criminals who'd been captured by the feds, who were pictured in their suit and this pair of white socks. And there's an image in a Wallace Stevens poem people are probably familiar with, of someone lying dead with their horned feet covered. Of course, in a Wallace Stevens poem, I can't say that's what it's about because it might not be, but it was the idea of dead people's feet. Is this a really bad idea for poem? Let's just go ahead and see where it goes. And it's partly because there's a novel written by a Northern writer called Brian Moore called The Emperor of Ice Cream. And when we were kids at school, this novel, and one of the guys in my class was a nephew of Brian Moore's, and everybody was excited not just about the novel, but the idea of Wallace Stevens. So it kind of came to Wallace Stevens through Brian Moore, and then came to the poem and thought, oh my God. So, on not putting on dead men's shoes. When someone's mother's brother that my father knew at college did his Bildungsroman thing near Big Sur, laying claim to a Connecticut insurance exec's impenetrable imperial title, it wasn't long before we discovered the Havana roller and his concupiscent Gilati, the rooting out of concupiscence being much desired in my father's mother's prayer book, though it wasn't wenches in such dress that got to me, rather the horny feet protruding from a sheet with fantails. Not stockinged like those forefathers first daguerreotyped for absent Yanks, or that the feds captured to show the hail of 50 caliber took out, say, Jesse, Emiliano, or Pancho, bless all their little coffin socks. More like Ernesto, who left barefooted, like something on a rollout tray in a Scandinavian procedural. Like the dead Christ our daughter led us to in Milan's Pinacoteca. Like someone's sudden feet protruding from a saffron and gold cloth on a bamboo pole litter, shouldered at the head of a straggled out roadside cortege this rising Easter morning past our Church of the Five Precious Wounds on the long route to Nican Bod Gat and its Yamuna firewood piles off the ring road behind Lal Kila. So it wasn't so terrible. This is about the 60s, if anybody remembers the 60s, they weren't there. So this is one of my many poems about the 60s. A band called Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, who had a hit called Shaking All Over. So the title of the poem is Shaving All Over. Not only did I get all the pirates' autographs that Lammas night, the year Lord Such screamed in a leopard skin leotard and opera hat at the Presbyterian Marquee, but I got to play on the backing band's baritone sax, taller than I was, sat at Frank Farley's drums. Clem Cattini had left for the Tornadoes by then, Mick Green for the Dakotas, and replaced a string on John Weider's guitar before he too left for Eric Burden and the Animals. But I woke the next bright August morning to find Kidd and the group balancing on our front railing like the Beatles in Help or the Monkees who wouldn't hear until Christmas, demanding my father from the Vicar, Father O'Brien, and organise a taxi to the civil airport. Not that my father was a dance hall promoter, despite his Blue Serenaders career, but the local teacher's the regular starting point for most problems. By September, I'd polished Mick Green's E minor riff from Shaven, and Engelbert was riding high. I can't remember if I cried when I read about the motor vehicle collision in England, but I switched to clarinet and swapped Johnny's Flourish for 3,000 Confederate dollars with signatures worthless for a century. And this one's, there's a book by James Baldwin called The Fire Next Time. James Baldwin, black gay American, part of the Harlem Renaissance, moved off to Paris after the war, as many black Americans did, and felt they were treated with no more dignity there than they were in America at that time. So The Fire Next Time seems to threaten what will happen next time. But this is a Ballycastle sort of experience of kind of racism, I don't know. But when I was very small, this must be when I was about 3 or 4, there was a, one year there was a cage, it's part of the Lammas Fair, which is the big fair that happens every year in Ballycastle. One of the exhibits was a cage lion. We went and paid to see the cage lion. This sounds like something out of Barnum in the 19th century, but believe me, it was there. And the next year there was a black guy dancing on coals, and that does sound like something out of the 19th century. So that's kind of the starting point for the poem. The fire next time. Hard to credit now, his mouth inflamed, dancing on live coals in the yard where a draggled ex-Chipperfield's lion lolled, stretched the year before. Hard to acknowledge the Huck Finn style wild man act was still seen there a century on, in a town retired had welcomed troops in wartime, including the sideman who passed off of my father an unusual Austro-Hungary pitched soprano sax, or disaffinato link to both Bartok and Beche. Hard to believe this long unpublished, buried even by an editor sensitive to criticism, wary of gifting the fascist black propaganda. This copperplate letter in the Herald's archive, a coloured GI imploring our Christian people refrain from calling them black sons of bitches, the colloquial has us to rights. A man beginning to doubt the Allied cause he's here to fight for. So after that bitter little piece, the title poem of this book, The Year of Not Dancing, one of the nice things about having a book with a cover like this on it is that you can persuade lots of people who don't even like poetry to buy it. But Blackstaff Press went to great lengths to get a picture of people not dancing, which might seem easy, but actually people who might be dancing but who aren't dancing, as opposed to simply a picture of people not dancing. So this is about the year that's kind of the midpoint between the time my mother died and the time when you go off into the adult world, if you like, when you're off to dances in your own life, and so on, starting to take off. And if I've got it right, this is my last poem. So what you need to know about this is not very much, except I use the word irredentist, which is a word, and then there was a whole argument in The Guardian about this, because The Guardian published this when the book came out, and people would say, that's not what irredentist means, but it is, because I say so. The irredentists were the people in Trieste who, because they hadn't got the Italy back from the Austro-Hungarian Empire, felt that it had not been redeemed, so they were irredentists. So irredentist, the word irredentist remains with us nationalists in the north of Ireland as a word for the unredeemed six counties. But it also exists in this poem in the sense that there's a certain point in your life where you can never get the past back. And so irredentist was the word, I was using the word in that sense, and people who would complain about it were wrong. There's also a curious thing. I mean, my father married again, and our stepmother brought us up, and there are some poems in here about her cooking, a very important part of family life, and she was an English teacher, and her interest in books, which obviously had some bearing on my life. But one of the books that she bought, she had all those book club editions, and she had books by Josephine Tay, which is a name that you hardly hear at all, and one of them is called Brad Farr, and it was part of the story was about a teenage boy who decides to swim out as far as he can, or swim out so far that he can never get back, and that's ghosting this particular story. Anything else you want to? That's it. The Year of Not Dancing. Hours passed languid as the flap of a hawk's wing in a last July before the awkward initiations of 15 and lifts to far afield jiving. He'd worked for an uncle, cutting hay, fixing shingles with Brad Alls and pot smoking pitch. Evenings hung round with fairground hands till the sideshows lit at 8. Then he'd sidestroke from the main pier, alone on a full tide, as far as the bobbing Perpetua, its line of cork floats, with dock and fairground small as a snow bubble town, bullhorns carrying Frank Ifields, when the angels asked me to recall out across a camp, irredentist blackness.